business in Alaska is holding their breath, and people don't want to spend money because nobody knows what's going to happen.
Testimony in the legislature for and against an income tax. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 17th. Good evening, Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, the incredible effort to build roads on the North Slope that'll melt back into the tundra.
When we walk away, you can look from the road or from afar and you wonder yourself, how did those pipelines get placed?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Wall Street Journal and other national news outlets are reporting that Mike Dubke is about to be named as President Trump's new communications director. Dubke is a political strategist based in Washington, D.C., but he's worked on several Alaska campaigns. He helped Senator Lisa Murkowski win re-election last year, and in 2014, his firm was the lead strategist behind Dan Sullivan's election to the U.S. Senate. Senator Sullivan said in a written statement today he could think of no one better for the communications job than Dubke. He also said Dubke has a lot of experience advancing pro-growth issues and knows Alaska well. Dubke founded Crossroads Media and also co-founded BlackRock Group, a political consulting firm. As of Friday evening, the White House had still not announced his hiring. Communications director typically works behind the scenes to hone a president's message and craft ways to deliver it, while the press secretary, in this case, Sean Spicer, faces reporters. Worthless is how a New York hedge fund labeled the value of Northern Dynasty stock in a report issued Tuesday. Northern Dynasty is the Vancouver-based company behind the proposed Pebble Mine, which the same report said is a project that will never be commercially or politically viable. The report sent the company's shares tumbling, which is exactly what the hedge fund investors were hoping for. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The report was authored by Carisdale Capital, which is run by investor Sam Andrangi.
What we specialize in is, you know, finding companies that we believe are overhyped or overly promotional about their prospects. And, you know, we present our contrarian views. And with Northern Dynasty, you know, our research has led us to believe that the mine's not economic. And, you know, the company's being valued at $1 billion, but we think that that's not the appropriate valuation because the mine will never be commercially viable.
Carisdale Capital is a name few, if any, stakeholders surrounding the controversial Pebble project had heard of till Tuesday. The company used Twitter and a large Washington, D.C.-based political advocacy firm to tease out the findings of its report, and Northern Dynasty shares plummeted when markets opened Tuesday morning. And Drangi says this is what Carisdale does. They look for companies they think are overrated or overrating themselves, research them, and publish the results to try and drive the share price down. It's called activist short selling, where the investor makes a profit by borrowing shares, selling them high, and buying back at a lower price, according to Bloomberg News. And Drangi says Pebble and Northern Dynasty came to his attention after the election, when Northern's shares shot up over 300% in value.
You know, ultimately, we're an investment firm that's trying to generate returns for our investors through challenging, promotional stories. And, you know, this stock price is up a lot since the Trump election. And, you know, the premise is that the new EPA head's going to reverse the Obama veto.
But Andrangi believes there is much more that will block the mine's development than an about-face from EPA, if that even occurs. In the 20-page report, he spelled out why he thinks the low-grade ore won't be profitable to extract and the large political hurdles the developers will encounter every step of the way. He cites the prior companies who have walked away, including Anglo American, which put more than $500 million towards Pebble before leaving the partnership. And Drangi says he's not allied with conservationists, fishermen, or tribes opposed to Pebble, and didn't really know anything about it till the stock price recently took off. His only aim was to challenge Northern Dynasty's value publicly and bet that the market would follow his lead.
I think in this instance, we were successful in drawing a lot of attention to our report and getting people focused on our arguments. In other situations, we're a lot less successful, and you know, the market just doesn't really care and, you know, is focused on other news items. And we just, you know, we move on to our to the next company that, you know, we feel ought to be challenged.
Pebble was caught off guard by the report and the sudden challenge in the investment arena, where they have otherwise enjoyed several good months of rising value. Spokesman Mike Heatwell offered comment as the company took a first read-through Tuesday morning.
We're still pouring through it because there's quite a few inaccuracies that we'll identify probably later in the week. But at a high level, I think it's important to note that the company that published this acknowledges that they have short positions in Northern Dynasty, which means that if the stock price is driven down, they stand to make money.
Northern Dynasty shares dropped from $3.02 down to $1.92 after the report was published Tuesday morning. They climbed back up to around $2.50 by the end of the day, where they continued to trade Wednesday. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Public testimony was split today on a bill that would introduce an income tax and use money from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. The measure would create an income tax that's 15% of federal tax liability and set permanent fund dividends at roughly $1,100. Martin Stepatin of Juneau supports House Bill 115.
We have a situation right now where business in Alaska is holding their breath, and people don't want to spend money because nobody knows what's going to happen. So we need to do something here in this building to get it done.
About 80 residents signed up to testify on the bill. Palmer resident Shannon Connolly says the legislation would steal from the permanent fund and residents' pockets.
You've created a spending monster, and now that the oil prices are down, you refuse to decrease your spending. Instead, you expect the working citizens of this state to pay for your incompetence. If I budgeted as you do, I would be in jail.
The Senate has discussed two other bills that would draw money from the permanent fund to pay for the state, to pay for the budget, but that don't include an income tax. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Iraqi family confronts new fears for their safety.
I come to USA to save my kids and my husband. What I do now? I can't back to my country.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaska has one of the largest wage gaps between men and women in the country. That's according to a new report from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released earlier this week. Women in Alaska who worked full-time in 2015 took home about 76% of what their male counterparts earned. David Kong is a statistician with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and he says the mix of jobs available in Alaska is one factor contributing to the wage gap.
In construction and extraction, which is a higher paid industry, it consists of 11.2% men and only less than 1% women. So it has something to do in part with the occupational mix in the state.
The ratio of women's to men's earnings in Alaska remains low compared to the rest of the country, but has gradually increased since 2009. The Alaska Board of Game will consider proposals to reinstate a no wolf kill area on state land along Denali National Park's northeast edge. The board imposed a moratorium on the controversial buffer zone proposals in 2010, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the issue returns to the board's agenda during a week-long meeting in Fairbanks that began today.
One of the two Denali Wolf Buffer proposals comes from the nonprofit Denali Citizens Council.
We're trying to reduce the risk on these wolves so that they can be viewed within the park and on state lands nearby by the hundreds of thousands of tourists that come through there every year.
Denali Citizens Council board member Nancy Bale says her group's proposal would ban wolf harvest year-round on a stretch of land west of Healy, an area where park wolves often roam, and a few are killed by hunters and trappers annually. A recent study shows park visitors were twice as likely to see wolves between 2000 and 2010 when there was a buffer in place. Denali National Park has also submitted a proposal to reinstate a buffer. Park Science and Resource Manager Dave Schierkauer says it would cover fewer acres than the DCC proposal and be in place 7 months of the year during wolf breeding, birthing, and pup raising season.
We view this kind of as a way to let the state meet some of their objectives for providing trapping opportunities while conserving wolves during the time period that they're most vulnerable to disruption.
Basically, the question is still the same, whether or not we want to close off about 152 square miles of state land and basically add it to the National Park Service system.
Alaska Board of Game Chair Ted Spraker underscores that the game board is primarily about setting hunting seasons to provide for sustained yield, and he's not convinced that the minimal harvest of Denali wolves in the proposed buffer is significant given the depressed status of area wolves.
Kind of an all-time low. So there's something more than just a few wolves being taken going on.
Buffer supporters point to hunting and trapping losses of single wolves that have led to the demise or dispersal of once popularly viewed Denali Park entrance area packs. Longtime wildlife advocate and biologist Rick Steiner sees protection of park wolves as a simple win given the popularity of Denali wolf viewing.
Visitors that contribute over $500 million to our economy. So it's in the state's interest to do this, but politically it's been a nightmare.
Steiner is not optimistic that the game board will approve a new Denali wolf buffer and maintains a state-federal land swap is a better alternative, and Spraker agrees.
Some sort of equitable land trade or some sort of hunting opportunity in another part of the state. I mean, you realize back in 1980 when all the parks and monuments were created, for instance, we lost about a quarter of all the sheep hunting. You know, if the state could get some of that back, they probably would be willing to trade some of this land and create some sort of a buffer and work with the National Park Service.
A land swap has long been discussed with no action, and with the game board meeting in Fairbanks, the focus is on buffer zone proposals. The group Alaskans for Wildlife organized a protest outside the Pike's Landing meeting location Friday. Group volunteer coordinator and retired wildlife biologist Fran Maurer of Fairbanks says one of their primary concerns is what he describes as the game board's insular nature.
It consists only of hunters, hunting guides, and trappers. There is no representation on the board for wildlife viewing, photography, wilderness guiding, tourism.
Maurer says the group is advocating for the Denali Citizens Council proposal for a larger year-round no-wolf kill buffer along Denali National Park's northeastern boundary. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Every winter, a massive infrastructure project takes place on the North Slope that's designed to disappear. Ice roads are built to minimize the oil industry's footprint on the sensitive tundra and melt away in spring. Many of the oil industry's multi-billion-dollar projects on the North Slope can't be built until the ice roads are finished. This January, Elizabeth Harbaugh visited ConocoPhillips facility in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, to see how an ice road comes together.
I'm in a van slowly lurching down the beginnings of an ice road on Alaska's North Slope.
Probably driving only over, in some spots, maybe as thin as an inch, 2 inches of ice.
And it is really bumpy.
You get used to it.
Should have brought my Dramamine. I'm on a tour arranged and paid for by ConocoPhillips. It's the only way a reporter can see how the oil company operates in this remote part of the world. It's a dim 7-degree day in January, and with me is Jeff Osborne, who oversees ice road construction for Conoco. It's a more important job than you might think. Here in the North Slope, oil companies like ConocoPhillips build hundreds of miles of ice roads every winter at a cost of about $400,000 per mile. Osborne explains that there are no permanent roads to the company's Alpine facility or to many of the pipelines nearby.
That's the amazing part. I don't know anywhere else in the world where you can build pipelines. And when we walk away and everything melts, you can look from the road or from afar and you wonder yourself, how did those pipelines get placed?
Conoco's North Slope work schedule hinges entirely on ice roads. The season lasts 90 to 100 days. During that narrow window, their alpine workforce doubles in size. Essential equipment like drill rigs, pipes, and cranes all have to be moved on ice roads. On a frozen lake, a big yellow cat moves back and forth across the horizon. What's left behind looks like a freshly plowed field, only it's frosty white. Huge backhoes scoop up ice chips and dump them into trucks. Back at the roadside, Osborne explains what happens next.
At some point in time, the blade will call the water truck up and have the water truck put some water down on the chips that have just been dumped.
After water is sprayed down, Mother Nature takes charge, freezing everything into place. Layer after layer is added until the road is at least 6 inches thick. And that's pretty much it.
I've always thought that ice roads were like an elegantly simple solution.
Melissa Head is with Alaska's Department of Natural Resources. She's on a team that manages ice road construction on the North Slope.
There really isn't much that's complicated about it. And that's the beauty of it.
The main purpose of ice roads, Head explains, is to protect the tundra's sensitive vegetation. Some plants native to the region won't grow back for years if they're disturbed. Environmental groups have raised concerns about ice roads. Lois Epstein with the Wilderness Society in Anchorage worries about the amount of water it takes to build them.
Where that water comes from, making sure that it doesn't deplete important lakes, river systems.
But Epstein adds her group doesn't oppose ice roads.
It is true. Ice roads are much better than permanent roads, gravel roads, so we do support their use.
This winter, Conoco begins construction on its Greater Moose's Tooth 1 drill site, one of the company's first big developments in the National Petroleum Reserve. Conoco usually builds about 35 miles of ice roads each winter, but for this project, they need an additional 80 miles. That means Jeff Osborne is keeping busy. Driving back to Alpine in the van, I have to wonder if ice road building feels like a Sisyphean task.
All that money and time and effort, patience, and then it melts away in the spring. What do you think about that?
Job security.
By late April, the ice roads he completed just a few months earlier will fade back into the tundra. And next year, he'll start all over again. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Join Alaskan leaders for an online discussion about civility in the last frontier Thursday, February 23rd from 5:30 to 7 at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Wesley Early. This week on AK, safe arrival. After 3 years of waiting for special immigrant visas, a family from Iraq finally arrived in Anchorage last fall. They were seeking safety and felt they had found it. But on January 27th, President Trump signed an executive order and things seemed to change for them. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more and, at the family's request, is not using their names.
It's mid-December and a middle-aged father sits at the dining table in his small Anchorage apartment, a tray loaded with tea and cookies on the table. He's talking about the process of getting his four kids ready for school.
In Iraq, I wake up them every day. Wake up them by water, by whatever, because they don't want to go to school. But here, they wake up alone. They go to bus alone. I'm not wake up them. This is good, very good sign to me.
He's talking to Vikram Patel, a radio producer who interviews people about what it's like to be a new arrival in Anchorage. The oldest son joins the conversation.
What's your favorite part about school?
My favorite part is play soccer, because it is my favorite sport.
Your dad thinks that your favorite part might be that there's girls at school now.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
The mother sits at the table, dressed in a heavy winter coat.
I like the snow. I like snow very much because this is the first time to me in Iraq, no snow.
Most of the conversation reflects what it's like for any family to move to a new city, new jobs, new activities. The father talks about his work fixing high-tech medical equipment. The mother, who used to teach, is going back to school and studying English. But for this family, being in Anchorage boils down to one key thing.
For us, really, the favorite part is safety.
They moved to Alaska because the father used to work as an engineer for the U.S. Army, which made him a target in Iraq. He says his father, his father-in-law, and other family members and friends have all been killed by militias. Bombs go off in the street. His life was threatened three times, forcing them to move to different places around Baghdad. So he applied for a visa to leave. During their first few months in Alaska, they reveled in the safety. He tells the story of the ski patrol at Alyeska helping his boys when they were lost, and talks about a time when the police showed up to help them deal with a rowdy neighbor.
I think here, the government protect all people.
Fast forward to late January. President Trump signs an executive order temporarily banning people from Iraq and six other Muslim-majority countries from traveling to the United States. He suspends the refugee program, too. A few days later, I sit down with the parents. The cookies, the tea, and the warm greetings are the same as during Vic's interview, but the mood is very different. The mother says when they first arrived in the U.S., she felt very welcomed by everyone.
I told to my husband, I'm very happy because no problem with Muslim. Why? No, it's a problem, Muslim problem now.
She says she's afraid when she goes outside that people will try to pull off her headscarf or will try to hurt her. Her husband suggested she stop wearing a scarf for her safety because God would understand why she made the choice. The father says they're also afraid for his sister and her family, who fled death threats in Iraq and are now in Turkey, wanting to join them in Alaska.
So they now waiting, in a small hope they coming, but with the Trump decision, now they are very disappointed. They are very sad.
The couple tried to explain what they see as a misunderstanding. Some people conflate all Muslims with members of the so-called Islamic State. Here they refer to that organization by its Arabic acronym, Daesh.
I am don't like Daesh. Don't like bomb. Don't like kill any people.
There is war in Iraq with Daesh. Muslim, they both Muslim, no Christian war with the Muslim. What does that mean? That mean the all Muslim Daesh? Why they fight them? Because they are not good people. I don't know what they believe, but they not represent the Islam.
They explain that they are Muslims, fleeing the violence of other people who call themselves Muslims. This family didn't want to leave their home in Iraq. They had good jobs there, a large house with plush red couches, an energetic German shepherd named Rocky.
But I come to USA to save my kids and my husband. What I do now? I can't back to my country. I can't do that.
Through a series of court rulings, Trump's executive order has been put on hold and is not currently being enforced. The long-lasting impacts of the ban and its rhetoric are still unclear. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Zion Phillips in Anchorage. Phillips is a UAA freshman and president of UAA's Black Student Union.
Born in Kansas, Wichita. I moved to Dover, Delaware. Then I moved to Lodgesfield, Azores. It's one of nine islands owned by Portugal. And then I moved to Texas, and then I'm here. I think I was able to see basically every part of the world. I'm the furthest west of America, and then I was the furthest east in America, and Midwest and South. So I figured I was able to see different points of America. So I think I have a pretty diverse outlook. When I moved here, I was asking my dad, hey, you were in the Black Student Union in college, what was that like? And he said, I liked it, I was in there for a few years, and I was like, hey, I'm gonna try that. So there's a lot of bigger campuses with a larger Black population. They usually have an established Black Student Union, and it's a huge organization where they do a lot of community service, education programs for Black folks to provide a safer space and to make Black folks more comfortable with being where they're at on campus, because they're usually the minority here. And I was asking folks around, so do y'all know what the Black Student Union is? Is there one here? And they're like, no, we don't have one. And I asked a few other people, and they said that there was one a few years back, but it hasn't been active in a few years. I talked to one of my advisors. She asked me, she said, hey, do we just want to bring it back up again? So there were four of us in a room, and they brought us here, and we just went down the list, and everybody were asked of what they wanted to choose as their roles. And I said, hey, I'll be president. And that's how that happened. Black History Month is it's like a reminder for us that the people that we're here because the people in the past fought for us, so we're here to celebrate them. There are designated days like President's Day and Veterans Day, but we designated ourselves to have a whole month. And I think this just allows us to come together as a community to figure things out.
Zion Phillips lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ann Hillman, Vikram Patel, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Wesley Early.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Shayla Farzan in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Mr. Eric Bork. Annie Feit edited and produced tonight's show. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The Kodiak Aleutians Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Kodiak February 22nd and 23rd at the Kodiak Best Western Inn from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.